Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. I'm Rachel Brown. In this laborious May Day episode, our regular format takes a day off, giving Ian Sansom more time to talk to Myra Zepf about working with myths and with children, and Don Watson reads some poems. Myra Zepf is the first ever Children's Writing Fellow for Northern Ireland, a role based at the Seamus Heaney Centre and supported by the Arts Council for Northern Ireland and the Atlantic Philanthropies. Don Watson is currently a PhD student at the Seamus Heaney Centre.
So how long have you been here at the Heaney Centre?
I started at the beginning of June in 2017.
Yeah.
So it's what's a year and a half, but more. Yeah.
And you're here kind of, and then that's, you're going to be here and here, or is, what's your thing here? What's the?
So it's a two-year fellowship. It's called the Children's Writing Fellow for Northern Ireland, and it's a really interesting thing because it was a coming together of the Arts Council and the Seamus Heaney Centre together as a Seamus Heaney legacy project. And I just have the best brief in the world. I have 2 years to just, basically the brief says, go and encourage and inspire little people.
Right.
As readers, as writers, the brief is as wide as that. So,
How do you do it then? What I mean, in terms of how you do that?
Yeah, it's been fabulous. There's been a. I went into it with a kind of a plan of how I wanted to do that. So there've been my projects that I've run as we've gone along, and I'll tell you a bit about those. But the really interesting thing about it has been that it's kind of been a bit of a magnet for other people doing things.
Right.
You come at you as well and say, well, will you get involved with this and that and the other? So it's been really wonderful that way. Iron filings.
Yes.
Yeah, just kind of creative writing iron filings.
Yeah.
Flying at me from every direction.
Right.
So I had my own project, and they've been very much school-based, but trying to go into schools and doing things in a completely opposite way, I suppose, to how very often in school writing always comes down to the mechanics and the technicalities. It's all about literacy. And it's very hard for the teachers to kind of separate out creativity from, you know, the actual technical how to write and how to read.
Yeah.
So what you find is when they're set a creative task, it's actually an exercise in handwriting and grammar and spelling and all of these other things. And it's very difficult for a teacher for that not to be the case. They have all their own things that they're trying to teach. So it's kind of really fun because I get to come in and go, forget all that.
Right. Let's do some crazy stuff.
Yeah. And because what you find is because of the way that those two things always come together, you find that you'll have children who just feel that they're not creative. Stories aren't, I'm not good at stories. I'm not good at making things up. And actually they are amazing at it. But what it is that they really struggle with getting it down on paper. Mm. So what I've been basing all of my emphasis on is opening out into the verbal. So we do sort of massive brainstorms and things, because I always say to them, like a writer, you don't sit down with a piece of paper and say, now I'm going to write my story. You tend to have something first that you're so dying to write that you've got no choice to not write it down. So it's getting them to spend that time first. That we might spend, you know, staring out the window or, well, tearing our hair out or whatever it is that we do before we actually write, and just sharing that with them and that space with them, and the idea that it's okay and it's cool to bounce things off each other and to see how they grow. There's a funny thing though, in large groups of probably anybody, but particularly children, it all gets very funny soon as you've got lots of them together. So we get very, very good at our comedy stories.
Right, yes. That's a bit like how I teach creative writing, Mara, to be honest, with university students, by the sound of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound dissimilar. Yeah. And how do you say brainstorm, what do you actually, any ideas, we'll put it on the whiteboard, or what's it actually?
You don't even do whiteboard,
like?
No.
Right.
So, the project I did last year was Head Over Heels, and it was all based on the idea of just inverting things, you know, just sort of upside down stories. So for that, I just had big bags of props, and so they would sort of take turns and come up, and they'd be like a witch's hat or a baby's rattle or whatever the things were that represented different characters, and we'd dragons and robots and whatever it was. And then we had to look at the character and then think about all of the things that we know about this character and then start turning them upside down. So they would end up with all these kind of like brilliant stories, like really mental stories.
Yeah.
It was really good fun. And then at the end of that project, we had a brilliant event in the Seamus Heaney home place with 5 illustrators who came and live illustrated the kids' drawings. And we
had
Dave Rodden, the writer, he was doing their narration of the kids' work. It was fabulous. So it was high speed illustration. Like
With
PJ Lynch, we had Mags Suggs, we had Peter Doherty. We did great and good kids' literature illustrations. So that was just wonderful for them to see real pros at work like that on their work, you know. But the big project I've been doing this year has been really different. So in answer to your question of how do you do it, well, this one has been based in heritage sites and landscape. So completely different. It's been around Mid-Ulster and we've been going to different sites. So like each school has gone to a heritage site right next to them. So some of them have gone to Knockmany Chambered Grave, which involved like an hour's mountain walk to get there to find these swirly stones. It was unbelievable. Other ones were in a stately home and Listen House, and we had living history actors and the whole thing played out in front of them. We had Turkey and Sweat House. We had Balahi Bon. And these are places that they don't necessarily normally have access to, even though they're right on their doorsteps. So it was meeting archaeologists, like finding, really going into the place and the history, and then going back, taking that. They had notes. They did have pen and paper. Most of them got soaked in rain and blew away in forests. And it was... but I don't think the pieces of paper were the important thing.
Yeah,
it was getting them to look at what they were seeing in new ways. And that was the conversation with them that time, was it's not about when you're writing it down in class, it's about when you're looking and what you're seeing in order to find things. Because it was going to be it has been a poetry outcome at the end. So they've written poems about these historic places, lots of them about the nature, because this is what they were really, really into when we went out into those environments. And then they've written poems, and there's an anthology then of all their work that we're going to launch in the Bernavon Theatre in Dungannon.
Goodness me.
They're
massive projects, aren't they?
They're really massive projects. And each one has been a complete learning curve for me. It's just been really interesting. And people just ask you to do things all the time. I think I've now got the reputation of, just throw her a thing and,
see what happens.
Which is great, because I've kind of just decided to own this. But just when you came into my office there, I've been sitting there trying to... Next week, I've got 2 days of... They said, will you just come and do poetry days? And there'll be 3 schools each day in the assembly hall, and you have all day. And I'm going, okay.
Wow. Okay, all right, yeah, fine.
So to get them acting out, doing art based on thing, writing their own... But it's kind of taking that kind of getting used to working with different groups of children, different age groups, and what you have to have them just active and doing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just kids, like you say. I don't think a lot of the things that are true of little people are any different for big people.
Peach season after Simon Armitage. She vanished at twilight across the field, slipping to the woods, after clearing the leaves off the porch, leaving a note for her wife and son, and dismantling all the windows. They'd given her a basket, and she filled it with peaches. Hours passed, and she lost herself in peach trees. Then a day, and she watched the orb spider knit a message between 2 scuppernong vines. Then a month, and she took an axe, made a pile of split wood. One night she tucked her wild legs beneath her and unscrewed them at the hip. At home, her wife and son grew tired of magnolia cones thumping the roof and the air conditioning unit rattling the walls. After a year, they scanned the fresh-cut field for a rare sight of dolphins. The night was a closed box, and they dug out a recipe for peach pie. When the giant butterfly came clattering up the hall, her wife could only freeze and hope it passed by. Her son stretched out his arms to mimic the vast wingspan. They puffed out their cheeks and laughed, taking turns to bite the wooden spoon. At sunrise, the boy ran ashore for his other mother and hoped she'd reappear in the water, the way sometimes the things we forget come back to us. Years passed, and from the woods she watched lightning debunk the boundary fence. The outhouse door walloped in the wind and storms tore up the yellow field. When she didn't return, her wife and son grew the peach trees higher and adjusted the recipe to reduce the nutmeg. In October, the stars set fire to the woodpile and cicadas clicked so loudly the peach stones broke.
It's an odd thing to end up doing, isn't it? In a sense, I mean, it's not, this isn't an everyday activity, is it? So how did you end
up... talking. Doing...
Well, yeah, fair enough. But I mean, how did you end up doing any of this in the first place then? What's your...
So I write books for children. That's what I do sort of first and foremost. And I write books for different age groups of children. So I've lots of picture books and I write chapter books and I write for teens. And so I suppose, like an awful lot of writers, the writing part is only part of your mix of your work, if you know what I mean. So it started with going out with my own books into different classroom settings to try and have workshops and events that were sort of inspired by or coming out responding to those books. And that's kind of how I started doing it. And people then would say, well, will you come and do Mother and Toddlers? And you'd go, okay. Right. Yeah, yeah. And you'd have to work out and research, what do you do with babies yeah. in a crowd to try, you know. So as more things came my way, then I suppose I just sort of developed a bit of a portfolio of things I could go to do. But that's kind of how it came about.
So you sort of made it up as you've gone along, haven't you? Like a story you made up. Yes.
In fact, I think that most of my creative output is not my books.
Right, it's all the other stuff, right, okay.
It's all this other stuff. And say in the coming month, I have I have workshops based on famine art. I have workshops based on Derry's walls and history. Then I have Hillsborough Castle have asked me to do something with children about the third Marquess of Downshire. And I'm going, okay.
Right, okay, yes. The good old third Marquess of Downshire. I've just got that off the top of my head. Yes,
no problem.
There. Right, yes.
So it's just kind of really interesting because you just get thrown things and then it's like, okay, I'm going to do something with this.
And the kind of writer who can do a bit of research and then turn something out of the research. Is that your kind of how you do your own stuff as well?
I think that's a bit more complicated because it depends what I'm writing, but lots of the picture books and things come from sort of the day-to-day life with children, I think, more than... research, or maybe that counts as research.
Well, yes.
So, living the research.
Yeah.
Frustrations and challenges and all of those things all get written into those books because I think that's in a lot of ways the way we interact with picture books as parents. It's kind of we want to send the children, we want to see our own kind of daily struggles and comic moments and crazy moments reflected in those. But it depends when I've written, for example, I have some historical fiction chapter books for children. Obviously, in those, the research is a completely different thing when you're actually trying to get all your historical facts in a row and whatever. I've just, a verse novel I've just finished, it's coming out in March.
Hey.
And it was really hardcore because the theme, for some crazy reason, the theme I chose was about online grooming and it's all very dark
okay.
and very difficult.
Right.
So in a book like that, obviously... the research that you have to do and the ways into it are very, very different.
But, I'm sure they are.
But I guess I do my research and whilst I'm doing that, the other part of it is percolating and then
it
kind of forms and then by the time you go to write. Then.
And is it quite unusual? It strikes me as being unusual for a writer to, you know, you're a children's writer, but you're one of those rare people who write just like from tiny to, you know, gruff.
Yeah.
YA type stuff.
It kind of surprises me too. I think what happens is that that's me as a parent. I think as my kids grow up, that I'm doing the same thing as I always was, but now we're grappling with, okay, how are your teachers talking to you about online safety and why are you not listening to your word they're saying?
Yeah.
Whereas it used to be about, why won't you eat your dinner or go to bed or whatever the thing was. So it's kind of those, and kind of the mentality of those different ages. I think that at each point I get kind of really interested in unpicking it because of my own personal
So maybe in a few years, yes, you'll presumably be writing
for adults. Yes.
Is that how this goes? I mean,
I really love picture books. It's like I think it's where my heart is.
And how did you get? Was it because as a child? I mean, you just interested in the what's the love of picture books? Where's that come from? Where's that?
Oh, I'm like a picture book obsessive.
Are you?
I really am. I think it's just one of the saddest things in the world that adults don't get like pictures anymore. Yeah. And it's just like this weird thing that you can read now, then you don't need this whole incredible visual text as well. You know, that there's, and it's that interaction between the pictures and the words and the in a good picture book you can't just, you know, if you take the pictures away the words don't work anymore.
Right.
And it's this wonderful thing. I'm supposed to be learning the craft as well, but how to write like that.
Yeah.
When actually sometimes, like some of my books will have 150 words in them, but then they'll have like, you know, you'll have like, you know, 5 words and then like a paragraph of notes for the illustrator.
Right.
What's happening in this is.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And that's writing. You know, it's all writing. You have to, but you have to visualize what you're all the time, what picture goes here, what's happening in front of me in a completely different way. I love the memory of being read picture books. It's a really, really deep, warm place for me, like a real gorgeous, safe place to go back to. And when I look at picture books from those days, the visuals just bring you right back.
At the gas station. The busted QT gas station is a wonderland. It sells lost things. Look at the cuckoo's bit, maggots in a brown bag, black ice in the schoolyard, Tybee Island skinny dips, unglued hugs. Those pumps are full of sassafras and sweet bay, 100 short-leaf pines. You can fill your tank with river birch. That motor oil is a just new strip mall in Athens. That gasoline is the advert with the talking dog. That diesel is Elsie's barn, mythic with honeysuckle. That mid-grade is how to take a bath in a Spartanburg pond. This canopy shelters truck stops, meat sticks, lottery tickets, and 26 flavours of slushy. You want advice? Put the nozzle in your mouth and fill up.
I also have that experience then with my own children of how picture books where we had all our conversations, where you could tap into where they were, where, because very often you're not just reading the story, you're reading all of the things that are going on, and you're able to talk about things through these characters, you know, this little bear that doesn't want to go to school or whatever the thing is, the rabbit who's fallen out with their friend, that the conversations that you can have via those other characters sometimes are just, they're so precious because and it's harder now. I mean, I'd love to be able to do that with teens.
Yes.
They read what they read and I read what I read, and it's very hard to engage them in that way. It's that shared reading experience. It's something really, really precious, I think.
And at what point do we lose that shared reading experience? What happens?
What happens statistically is that as soon as a child can read, we say, oh, good for you, you can read. Here, you need bigger books and longer books and cleverer books, and there's this whole kind of snobby hierarchy that we have. But as I said at the beginning, it all comes down to our ideas about literacy. It's like, you know, you're progressing through literacy, and you find that adults do this as well. It's like, you know, that kind of snobbery about, you know, are you reading a particularly difficult book? Is it like, you know, there's kind of ideas about good books and bad books, and so there's all of that sort of in our subtext about where we're trying to push children towards. And that's why then we stop reading to them, because we want them to be progressing on some kind of a line.
Yeah, so there's almost like a teleological kind of structure to the way we think about how we should move through
And for some reason, the amount of text, I mean, it makes me laugh, you know, that this is interesting in terms of poetry, you know, but that idea that there's this line and kind of the more text, then, you know, that's definitely there all the way through through school education. The more text you're reading, the better. And they have these kind of, you know, the accelerated reading program and whatever, when you become a reading millionaire because you've read a million words. And it's, kind of like this, rather than saying slow down, can you just read a few words, but maybe read them nice and slowly and think about them and respond and engage. And, you know, it's the opposite of all that.
It's like capital accumulation, isn't it? That we're encouraged to. I'd never even thought of that, actually,
So back to your question about, you know, when do we stop? Well, it's a wonderful thing when you can keep children reading, I think, a variety of things and reading with them, because you can be reading wonderful novels or whatever out loud, but people don't tend to do that, and they think that the children won't respond well to it, which they actually do always. They love the attention of it and the warmth of it. But we feel like we're competing against, you know, the latest computer game and this, that and the other. And, you know, why would they want to sit and listen to books with me? But it's a lovely thing when people can do it. But funny enough, I recently heard that there was like the school librarian of the year in England. And she was talking about working in a really difficult, challenging high school in the north of England in an area of serious deprivation, very hard to reach children or teens. And how she started a picture book club in the secondary school, you know, with cushions and hot chocolate and loads of picture books, and how amazing it was, you know, just in sort of mental health terms, that kind of, I suppose in a way that lots of people have come on at poetry now, and sort of that kind of mental health sense of slowing down and mindfulness and taking time and taking these, you know, sort of creative moments.
Yeah.
But that these kids are reading stuff that's just, there's so much kindness and warmth and truth in picture books. There's really gorgeous stuff, but also just kind of regression. You know, you're not on a trajectory. Nobody's pushing you to achieve. Let's just sit down and
Well, you've read got me in the mood stuff. for picture books. I have to say. the ones that I used to, I remember when I was, when my children were young, the ones that I really used to like, I used to like picture books where there was there's not a necessary or obvious relationship between the text and the book. So the pictures aren't an illustration of the text, aren't they? Are they? Is that right? Is that?
So the people would make the distinction between picture books and illustrated books.
Oh.
And that illustrated books, you can take the pictures away or leave them and it doesn't make any difference to your story. But very often, and this is what I mean by picture books and really good picture books, is where there's this conversation between the two. And as you say, sometimes it can be showing the opposite, you know, for comic value. His room was very tidy, and you see this kind of complete chaos or whatever.
Yes.
So sometimes it's they're in a fun relationship with each other, the pictures, there's just such a skill that illustrators bring to those books.
And so take me through how it works, because I don't understand the mechanics of how that would kind of work itself through. You come up with an idea, you write the words, and then you go and find an illustrator, or are you developing it with them, or?
So the straightest way, the normal way that it happens, is that you send your text to the publisher, and the publisher then sources the illustrator. And so you'll have provided notes for the illustrator, but say my first picture book, I didn't meet the illustrator until the book launch.
Wow.
You know, and so there's a bit of back and forth. Right, like when I saw her pictures, I changed some stuff in the text, or you go, I don't actually need to say that anymore, it's in the picture. Do this kind of thing. In that particular case, I looked at this this character and I went, oh, I don't think his name really suits him anymore.
Yeah.
And I changed his name. So there's kind of a back and forth, but it wasn't between me and her. And that's the normal way that it happens. I have a series of picture books I'm working on at the moment with an illustrator called Andrew Whitson, who's local. And he and I work completely differently and quite unusually, in that we do a lot of back and forth in the middle of it, you know. So I'll send him an idea and he'll, you know, send me a funny sketch from something we've been talking about, and the thing grows. But no, it's still very much you send the text and then they then imagine. And this is the bit that's really interesting, because they're kind of imagining, like, say it's your character or the world that they're in. They're imagining it maybe in ways that are really different from how you've imagined it. and there's a huge skill in what they do. And but it can be a confusing thing at the start. You kind of go, oh, I have to take a wee minute to get used to this.
Because you've got a picture already in your head. Yes, yeah. Presumably, yes.
Is that what their house looks like? Right. Oh, gosh, I never thought of that.
Are you kidding?
I'll write something. And because Andy and I would work very closely together, he'll go, that thing that you've written works in terms of a narrative, but it doesn't really make it for a good picture, you know. Or like sometimes you'll write things and although the thing's escalating or doing whatever in your head, actually the pictures are staying, you know, you're still in the same room and you have to, and then they go, no, I need a different setting. Or so it's quite interesting in terms of that, the needs of the visual versus the needs of the text and how different they are.
And have you ever been tempted to think to yourself, well, I've worked with a few illustrators, I think I might have a go at the old illustration luck myself, so that you could actually, no.
I just can't believe my luck that I get to write stuff that other people do incredible stuff with, like really turn into things that I turn the page and gasp at, you know. And there's just no way in a million years. The more that you see about what they do, the more you realise the level of skill involved in that.
And so what's the next thing? So you've got this young adult thing coming up. Have you got, so what else have you, it sounds like you've got quite a lot.
I have 5 books coming out this year.
You have not 5 books?
Yeah.
Is that your average, that's not your average annual kind of output?
I'm sort of on speed at the moment. I don't know what's going on.
Right.
So, I have this picture book series with Andy. So we just are, we're really on a roll with those. So I have a ninja book coming out and an alien book with Rita. I have the young adult first novel. And then September, I have a really interesting book that I'm really looking forward to, and it's a picture book, but it's a rewriting of an old Irish myth.
Right, okay.
So it's the story of Mirren Aidin, or Etain as she would have been known in the old versions. And it's a really different thing to have done. It's a really romantic love story. Well, I shouldn't dwell too much on the really old versions of this myth because, you know, you're talking about research. I loved going into all the old versions, and some of them are like really don't really fit with our modern ideas of romantic love. Let me just leave that there.
Okay.
So the story that I would have grown up with as a child of Mir Ag Aidin was about this young girl, Aidin, and she's in love with Mir. And then there's this horrible woman called Fumnach, who in the old stories was actually married to Mir, which explains why she was being a bit horrible.
Right, okay. it's getting a little darker and stranger now.
Already. But in the kids' version, I go, she was just this random jealous, you know. But she transfigures Aidin into a butterfly. It's a little bit like the Children of Lir. It's got a shape to it that's recognisable from that. So she turns her into this butterfly, and then she sets these crazy winds blowing and sends her out for 7 years where she can't, very like the Children of Lir. She, you know, she's tossed on the seas and in the winds, and it's all to separate these two lovers. And so she spends some time with Engasog, and that's all quite very interesting in the old version, but we're going to skim over that. She gets blown into this.
I feel you're leaving out some of the best bits.
I'm leaving out. Oh, man, if you could. That's a whole other podcast. Right.
Okay.
So the butterfly eventually gets blown into this feasting hall of some mortals. I didn't really mention this, but we were in the immortal world. We were in the Tuatha Dé Danann kind of Chernan Og world. But we're in the world of mortals now, and she gets blown into this feasting hall, and she falls into a glass of wine, like a goblet of wine.
Oh, no.
And gets drunk by the wife of this chieftain.
Oh.
And reborn, okay?
Inside her?
Yeah, she's then pregnant.
And, you are joking.
And the butterfly takes human form again. And so then this new girl, who's also 18, she gets married off to the High King, and a sort of arranged marriage and all this, and then Mir turns up, and then he wins her in a game of chess, and
he wins her back.
Is like the old story that I grew up with. It's an incredible story. It's got some real like iconic kind of stuff in it. But I was given the task of, okay, this is the story. Now, when you think about it, you've got this female protagonist who is bought, sold, bewitched, transfigured, reborn, blah, and, you know, won in a game of chess. I mean, she has no agency whatsoever in any of this, even though it's her story. And it's just not how we, it just doesn't chime anymore with how we want the stories that we want for our girls, well, girls and boys, in this age of trying to understand, you know, consent and healthy relationships and all of these things.
Oh,
this,
I see, you've made that connection, just, I see.
Just,
right.
It's
okay.
Just all yes. wrong yes. In the way that lots of people are feeling that, lots of the Grimm's fairy tales and all the rest of it. We're in a time of seeing people saying, okay, we need to make our own again of these stories that we love and make them relevant and right for now and with our values. It's something that, like I keep mentioning these crazy old versions, but it is obviously an ongoing process. And that's the idea that, you know, when stories are still alive and they're still getting changed and they're still growing over time. So I was given the task of this story, yeah, to make it work for now, you know. And
so what have you done?
Enjoyed
what have you done then?
Well, for starters, she's brilliant at chess.
Oh, I like it.
So right. She wins her own hand at the end, sort of by beating the high king.
She wins her
chess.
Own hand.
Well, she wins her choice. You
oh,
know?
I see.
And she
yes,
wins,
gotcha.
Yeah,
yes,
she,
right, fine.
So, but the whole way through, you know, she's still the victim of the magic and all the rest of it. But you have a very different sense of her agency, but also of her strength of character and her resilience through it, in a way that, in a way, again, that we would recognise from fairy tales, that very often those characters are kind of like more like cardboard cutouts, you know, they're just archetypes rather than proper characters,
yes.
You know, depth
yes.
of character, you know, how would she have been feeling, how
yeah.
would she, so it was writing that back in helps as well then, and her kind of making her a proper rounded
character. So is that what you
did,
partly you're kind of feeling it, it's that sort of sense of, oh, I'm trying to think of an example, well, I think it's, isn't it, oh, who's the chap who wrote Mimesis, the Auerbach, who has this idea that there's, you know, in terms of depth, it's to do with things having a, being what he calls fraught with background, mm-hmm. having a kind of, literally a kind of depth to it.
Yeah.
Is that one of the, that's one of the things you're
yeah,
doing, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. And it was trying to work out, because when you're handed something that feels precious and old and that you value and respect, there's something slightly sacred about these old things. And
yes, you don't want to
yuck
it up, do
how
you?
Much can you change, how much can you not change, when you take it all apart, which are the bits that have to go back in and which aren't, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just really interesting, and so there was quite a lot of, like, I had so many versions where I went too far one way and too far, I had a
right.
complete Disney version, which was like
right, okay.
Do you know the way they
well,
do those
could,
Disney films
worked.
Where they take
right.
one element that exists from the story and then they just write a whole new one? So I had kind of from that extreme to the really, really pared down, and just trying to find the middle of changing it but keeping it intact. And it was a really interesting process for me of just, what is a story? When is it still the same story?
Yeah.
Or when
is
have
it?
You
yes,
actually
like,
written
yes,
a new
yes.
story?
Yes, like my grandfather's hammer type thing, isn't it? Where, you know, you replace the
exactly.
shaft and you replace the head.
And is it still...
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
It's very much that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a point where I just literally had to write on the page, okay, these are the things, and just draw a little box around them that you have to have in this story. You know, she has to turn into a butterfly. She has to be reborn. She has to play. There has to be a game of chess.
Yeah.
There has to be this king. You know, and to actually just put the elements and say, now, once you've got those, now you can play
right.
and see how you can fit this together and who can you make her without changing too much.
So, I mean, I'm interested because you made that sound like quite a conscious process that you would go through. Is it that
for
conscious?
That project, it really was.
Was it? Right.
Yeah, because yeah. I think it's when you're given something that's not your own to start with. When
right.
you're,
oh, yes, you have a, you have a responsibility.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a completely different feeling from when, you know, when the page is clean and it's your own, all of the ownership is yours. And this is just, it's more like, you know... you're half creating and half preserving or maintaining or It's a really difficult. I find it really, really fascinating.
So like almost that. It's curatorial just to pick up your metaphor there, as if you were in a museum and you're presenting this material for a new audience in a new way. You know, when you go to a museum and it used to be those little handwritten sort of little cards, and you think, and with badly lit display cases. Yeah. Whereas now it might be a completely different
It's a really interesting analogy, because you can completely change the story of an artifact, or you know, the context of it, the framing of it in a museum context. And I guess that's what we're trying to do. But for me, I think because it was a story that I was talking earlier about picture books and being read picture books on my parents' knees. Like, this was one of the books that stories from my childhood. And so you've got this kind of sense of awe of like the incredible long history of a story, and then also the sort of personal, oh my goodness, there's going to be another generation of children who are going to be the new me, who this is going to be their version, you know. Yeah. And it's been really fascinating.
What changed in the love story then, in terms of apart from her agency? I can see changes. Were there other elements that you had to change, where I don't know, did she end up with the same chap at the
I shouldn't give any spoilers.
Oh, maybe she does.
Of course she does. Okay. It's a story of, you know, the longevity and the resilience of love and the just unbreakable bond, you know, that even when you've been, you know, transfigured and reincarnated and bewitched and all of these things, and the power politics of being, you know, paired off with the High King and all of these things, and against all odds, that their love, you know, is just sort of unbreakable, and the rightness of their love together and how they interact together. And that's shown as well, you know, that like I was saying about healthy relationships, and it's not just a magical love, if you know what I mean, that you would have in stories where you just accept these people just are in love and that's the way, but that you can also see in the story why they love each other and why this is a good thing that you're rooting for from the start. So that's, yeah, it's a deeply romantic story. And as I say, the original story, oh my God, it is so different. She then is, when she goes in the original, when she goes to be married off to the High King, Ochi, his brother falls in love with her, and then he's wasting away. He's actually dying out of love for her because he can't have her, like physically, he's on his deathbed. And the High King goes off on progress and leaves her in charge, and he says, "Now you look after my brother." And so she finds out why he's dying, and she says, "Okay, well, this isn't really perfect, but you know, if I sleep with you, will you live?" And he says, "Yeah, that would probably help."
That would do
So they arrange this kind of, you know, so she goes to meet him, and she says, "Oh, well, you know, we shouldn't sleep together like in the castle. So maybe in the hillside or something." And so they go and meet each other at night. But he falls into this magical deep sleep, and he can't come. And this happens 3 nights after each other. And then it turns out that it was Mir who the whole way through had made all this happen so that he could come in this other man's form to meet her. It's mental.
I'm looking skeptical, but at the same time, it sounds fabulous. Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Yeah. And presumably you grew up then with these stories in Irish, did you? As a kind of ignorant non-Irish speaking individual, where would I find those stories in a good kind of recent English translate? What's a good place to start, do you think?
I find that with Irish myths, there are certain stories that it's really easy to find good tellings of, and then there's other ones that are sort of unknown in English. And that's an interesting thing. What is the name of that book that Mary Heaney wrote?
Is it Nine Waves in the title? If you want
somewhere to start.
Okay, good.
But yeah, it's kind of one of those things, once you start hooking about in it, it becomes all the more fun when you find all the contradictory versions. And I suppose with oral tradition, there's that sense in which things grow in all different directions, and then don't necessarily fit to go. What starts as one story, you know, takes different versions. But I think in the case of Mir and Aideen, there was like a manuscript that was found at one point that was incomplete. So everybody then went, oh, this is this wonderful story. And then they didn't have the context at all. Right. And actually, the Mary Nadine story was not really supposed to be the real romantic love. I think she was supposed to have kind of led him astray. You know, if you were in this longer collection of different stories right. that were weaving in and out of each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you can't beat an unfinished manuscript to be able to let your imagination run wild, can you? That's perfect.
Absolutely.
That's perfect. Well, should we I think we should we'll maybe say thank you very much. And thank you for telling us all about that. And I think everyone's going to read that one, aren't they?
I hope so.
Yeah. Good. Super.
Don't shoot, sir. On the North Poinsett Highway, in sleepy traveller's rest, I made a left into a coffee house when I should have given way. A cop car squealed into the parking lot. I switched off the engine. He walked to my window, hand on gun. I called him sir. He told me to get out, open the trunk. He said, ma'am, do you understand I can shoot you and your son and your wife and your brother and his husband right here in the parking lot? The smell of coffee was distracting. I said, don't shoot, sir. I'm going to give you my shoes and my laces if you want them. The people watching were yellow. I said, don't shoot, sir. I'm going to give you my black ice, my dead flower drift, my fat red bone coonhound. The cop was a smoke trail. I said, don't shoot, sir. Forgive me. I will give you my license. The trees were red lights switched off and on in the blue autumn. The watching crowd ate snow cones thoughtfully. From a nest, the cop took a bird and told me, hold it. I climbed into the car with the bird in my hand and it dashed. I cried and said, I think this bird is a gun. And it dashed and dashed.
The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast is created in a small back room by Ian Sansom, Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown, with thanks to producers Chantal Aylesby and Toby James, and to Nick Boyle for his music.